afternoon we have Dustin Lang from Perimeter. We'll guide you through some Markov chain Monte Carlo methods. So it's quite a different of lecture from these mornings, and in general, the morning sessions, we tend to be a bit more theoretical. So it's a good compliment. Please.
Oh, thank you. Okay, mic is on. Hey, Josh. Thank you for coming. As Aldo said, this is gonna be quite a different flavor from this morning. And I think I have quite a different background from most of you, so I hope that I'm providing enough context and introduction and like description of like why you would want to do this these computations. But please jump in if I've lost you or if I'm using terminology that's not clear. I know there's a lot of jargon here, so, and I'm trying to kind of introduce and be aware of the jargon, but I'll probably miss some of it. So please jump in with questions. It's a small enough group that I'm very happy to get, to steer discussion according to what you're interested in. I think this might be quite different than stuff you might work with in your everyday lives. So my goal is to give you a little glimpse into this world and maybe show you some terminology or methods that you might hear more experimental people talking about. And maybe you'll find some connections to your work. When I was preparing these slides, I found that one of my colleagues and co-authors, Dan Foreman Mackey, made some beautiful slides. So instead of trying to remake slides, I just wholesale borrowed a lot from him. I believe his license is very permissive of that, so that's we're okay. And these slides are available on GitHub if you'd like to, whatever. Follow along on your own or read them later or whatever. So here's Dan's version of the title slide, and just from that you can see that he has more graphical design stuff going on than I do. So here's Dan's flashy big picture view. And so for me, Markov chain Monte Carlo comes up in the context of doing data analysis, and in particular trying to use this generative style of data analysis. You might also hear this called forward modeling or model-based inference. And the idea is that we're gonna try to come up with basically a description of how our whatever physical process of interest we're thinking about, how it manifests itself in the data in a kind of pretty concrete form. And then once you've set up that statistical framework, then you can flip it over and you do inference to try to understand things about the physics constrained by your data. And I'll go into gory detail about what this actually looks like in practice. So this is sort of the context where this comes up. I should say these algorithms do get used in other contexts, but this is sort of one zoom in or glimpse into this. Okay, so here comes a bunch of notation or statistics talk. So what I was just saying there, this the top part, that P of data given physics is how you pronounce that top line. Is where we try to write down a probability function or a likelihood that says, that tells us how probable or how likely it is for us to have drawn that particular data set given a particular model of the physics. and so that it's kind of, yeah, it's telling you sort of how likely your data would be if that physics were true. But the thing you kind of usually actually want to talk about is you want to make some statement of the probability of some, say, physical model parameters in constrained by your data, or given your data. And in order to do that, at least in my world, you have to be Bayesian. You have to use Bayes' rule to kind of flip that probability distribution around. Which means that it pulls in this P of physics term, which is called a prior. And some people find that objectionable and refuse to use Bayesian statistics on that basis. In my world, it's just, I guess I was Bayesian before I knew there was really an alternative, so it's just a fact of life. So yeah, basically this, you know, in this setup, the Bayes' rule lets us, you know, do this kind of constraining physics, given our data. And I should say this notation is horrible. You know, there are four P's on here and they're all different functions, right? They're all like different probability functions. And you only know which function they are from the arguments that go into it. So really it should be, you know, these have four different functional forms. They really should be called like P1, P2, P3, P4, or something like that. It's a mess, but it's also the convention and it's everywhere. So all I can do is apologize for the, you know, terrible notation. Okay, so I'm gonna walk through an example because I hope that that will make what I'm saying a little bit more concrete and maybe show you that it's like, this actually applies in some, at least some little corner of the real world. So this is an example from Perlmutter et al. 1999, pretty important paper in cosmology. And what they did was, this is experimental cosmology, so they were, they observed a sample of supernovae, and in particular, this type called type 1As. And they're basically a particular kind of supernova explosion, and they're thought to be basically all the same, like to all have more or less the same intrinsic brightness, because there's like the particular scenario that yields that kind of explosion is constrained so that it only happens when in kind of a particular set of circumstances. So they're thought to be kind of mostly intrinsically the same. And so that's wonderful because you can use them as what cosmologists call a standard candle. So, you know, something that a bunch of objects that kind of have the same intrinsic brightness. So you know, this was a ton of work because they had to monitor the sky and wait for things to explode and then observe them over the course of weeks as they sort of brighten and then fade again. And so they report basically the peak brightness, or you can think of it as something like that, the peak brightness of this sample of supernovae. And then for each of those supernovae, they can also observe the host galaxy. So each of these supernovae is one star within a larger host galaxy, and you could measure the host galaxy's redshift. And the idea is basically, this is in weird astronomer units, so magnitudes bigger is fainter, and then the redshift is sort of like, for us, is sort of like distance, or like a proxy for distance. Distances in cosmology are weird. There's like six different kinds of distance, and it's confusing which one you want to be talking about at any time, but so redshift is sort of one of these proxies for distance. So this is telling you that as you get further, if you take the same thing and put it further away, it gets fainter. Not super surprising, but in cosmology, it doesn't get faint the way you experience in your everyday life of inverse square law, it does something else. And exactly the shape of what it does depends on what ingredients are in the universe or what your cosmological model is. So, in cosmology talk, that means something like you have this intrinsic magnitude for a type 1 supernovae, and then the thing that makes it get faint is this distance thing called luminosity distance, which is basically just like how much fainter it gets at a given redshift, and then there's also parameters that are, here are parameters of your cosmological model. So, for example, how much mass is in the universe? Okay, so I'm gonna stick with this for a little bit more. So, I meant to reorganize this slide. So there's a little bit, So the generative model here basically is that for each of these supernovae, its magnitude is, you know, that intrinsic magnitude plus some luminosity distance that depends on its redshift. And then also that epsilon I, which is, a noise that, an additive noise that comes with the measurement. So depending on, you know, what exactly your experimental setup is, there's always kind of some noise kicking around in the system. For this kind of task where you're measuring the brightness of a star, one thing that can get in the way is that there's also some like background level or like sky level. So in other words, the sky isn't totally dark. So you also observe something from like basically a smooth sheet across the sky. And so that's contributing a bunch of photons. And then there's photons coming from your star. And those things are mixed together. You can't tell which is which. And the background one, you can model as a Poisson process. But then as you get a lot of counts, the Poisson turns into a Gaussian. So basically it, you know, adds an amount of Gaussian noise to your measurement. So that's exactly what they assume in this situation. Pretty common thing to assume that your noise process is an additive Gaussian. So that means that then, on the second line there, the Gaussian, that Gaussian is, you know, a concrete like formula for the probability distribution of drawing, of observing a particular magnitude I, given that the predicted, model predicted mean of that distribution is, you know, some function of the redshift and the and cosmological parameters. Okay, so they've made two other assumptions here. One is that all of the data points are independent, and then therefore, if you look at the probability or the likelihood of the whole data set, it's just the product of the individual likelihoods. So that's where the big product in the second line comes from. And what else did we assume? Oh yeah, so on the very right-hand side of that, you can see there's these sigma i's that are part of the Gaussian. And so what they've assumed is that they understand basically the magnitude of those additive Gaussian noises or errors that are included in the measurements. Okay, and another really strong thing they've assumed is that they have measured the redshifts z quite precisely, and they also know the sigma i's. So they're not gonna, like, those don't enter into their probabilistic model or their, in the statistics, they're just treated as constants. Which is kind of reasonable if your measurements of the brightnesses are considerably noisier than your measurements of the redshifts. And in this case, that's pretty accurate because it's pretty easy to get the redshift of a galaxy to, you know, 3 or 4 digits of precision, whereas the magnitudes are more like, you know, a few percent or 5% or 10%. Okay, any questions up to here? I hope that means I'm not boring you. Please go ahead. Oh, actually, hang on a sec. I'll throw you a cube, or I'll pass you a cube so that we can, I think we do have some people on Zoom, so people on Zoom can also feel free to jump in with questions. Here. I would throw it, but we already broke one carafe today, so we have a quota.
So, it's a very naive question, and I don't know anything about data analysis.
Sure.
So why are we calling this a generative model? Means why the word generative there? Means why, what the, are there other kinds of things that are not generative?
Yeah, good question. Okay, so I guess I don't have to repeat the question because you've got the mic. That's great. So it's generative in the sense that we're trying to make the model make a prediction in the space of the data. So another kind of style you can get is where you compute some summary statistic from the data and compare that to a model prediction. Here, it's trying to work. You're trying to make the model do more work and try to move more toward the data space. And the reason that is sometimes preferred is that you can model some of the weirder things that can happen in the data collection process. So for example, dealing with outliers is relatively easy in this framework, and it's pretty hard in other, like if you try to do summary statistics, and you might have some outlier data points mixed in with your real data points. That's harder to deal with those.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. I guess you can keep, that's closer to the center of mass of people with questions probably, so that's good. Okay, thanks. Any other questions now before I keep going? Okay. They say you're supposed to wait like uncomfortably long for questions, so I'm doing that. I'm uncomfortable. Okay, I'm moving on. Okay, so so plugging in, I should have flipped the second and third lines. I should have made the product be on the bottom line. But anyway, just to plug in the parameters they're actually using in this situation, those are these omega m and omega lambda. Oops, sorry, highlight doesn't work quite the way I was expecting. Omega m and omega lambda. So those are, in astronomer speak, the amount of mass and amount of dark energy in the universe. So they're trying to infer how much mass and dark energy are in the universe based on these measurements. It's pretty cool that, you know, basically you can measure this based on a cosmological model that says how faint things get as you move them away from you, or as you redshift them away, or as the universe grows and redshifts them away from you. Given that you think you observed a set of things that were all intrinsically the same brightness. So another thing to notice kind of is that, I guess it was a little sloppy with the notation, but really this mag int, like the intrinsic magnitude of that thing, is also, or you could also treat it as a model parameter. You might know from some other evidence how bright they are intrinsically, but often that's another thing you would have to infer from the model. And it's kind of not something you probably intrinsically care about, so that's often called a nuisance parameter. So it's something you have to infer, like it's something you have to constrain, but you don't actually fundamentally care about it. It's not going to really make a big splash in your paper. The really headline things are these omega m, omega lambda. But that's actually one of the reasons not to do this generative model, because you often end up with more of these nuisance parameters that you then have to like spend some of your data on to learn about, and you don't fundamentally care about them. Okay, right, so, you know, again, people don't really care about fundamentally about the likelihood. They care about the posterior distribution of what you can say about omega matter and omega lambda. In that case, so then this requires using Bayes' theorem. And I believe in Perlmutter in 1999, they take a pretty common approach of trying to choose a prior, this term P of omega m omega lambda. You have to put in something for the math to work. It's basically to make the units work out right in the statistic math. But people usually try to write down what are called uninformative priors or flat priors. And this is often, there's like a whole subfield about about priors, and people spend a lot of time worrying about it. But the idea is basically that you have to plug in something, and it goes into the math, you know, along with your data. Like it really scales what you come out with. So people try to write down something that is like, say, flat over a big part of the landscape. So in this case, like the natural units for omega m and omega lambda are like 0 to 1. So you might say, oh, I'm going to just make that probability surface, just constant over that surface area, over that area in parameter space. although we know that if you actually, in some places in that parameter space, if you had that, there would be no Big Bang, or like there would be nothing in the universe. So there's like obviously not what we actually believe. And yet it's what people usually write down in an effort to be kind of uninformative or to not like subjectively skew the results. So it's a thing people worry about a lot, but you know, it's one term and then you multiply it by all of your data. So if you have a like informative enough data set, it usually doesn't really matter very much, but it's a kind of issue that comes up. Especially if you're trying to squeeze like some result out of a marginal data set. So people are really, I saw a talk last week where there was a lot of worry about some effect based on the priors, and it was because it was like a, you know, two or three sigma kind of result, and it was kind of marginal, so the priors could potentially matter. But basically, if the priors matter, you're usually in a kind of sketchy situation anyway. Okay, so, oh yeah, right. If I flip back to the previous, just look at the plot for a second, you'll see like an imperceptible change in the fitting line. And then, so one of the nice things about this method, this kind of generative or forward modeling method, is that you can make your model make predictions in the data space. And if you have some uncertainty on those model parameters, you can like draw a few samples from that distribution and say, okay, within the range of possible parameters, what predictions do they make in the data space? This is not a good example of that. I've drawn 10 of them and they're basically all on top of each other, showing that there's not really that much freedom to move around in this data space. Here, let me flip back and forth once again and you'll see that it's like pretty imperceptible. Okay, I should have plotted that in some different way to highlight the difference. And then here's their kind of headline result. This is plotting up now in that omega m, omega lambda space, how their data allow them to constrain the parameter space. So their constraints are those blue ellipses. Right, so the central blue, the darkest blue ellipse is like their one sigma error bar, or one sigma error, yeah. this is a much larger range of those parameters than you usually see, because in the last 20 years, we've sort of zoomed in onto an area that's like, supported by more data, but basically, depending on what you put in your universe, different things can happen. You know, in the top left, no Big Bang, universe expands forever or recollapses. Flat is often preferred just for theoretical reasons. And so basically the headline on their paper is that if you assume this flat universe, then you basically can't have, like their data rule out this possibility that lambda is zero. Like, you know, if you insist on being on this line, then their data say there's no way you can be at zero. So in other words, that's, it proves that dark energy exists. And so they won the Nobel Prize for that. Not bad for fitting a line, right?
So the slant line is for flat, means that lambda equals zero, and what is that? Is that intersection point? The intersection point is not in our contour, and that's why you are ruling out lambda equals zero.
Yeah, that's right. Like this, Yeah, this point is not
so,
is like
but
many.
The, if the whole line is for flat space, then there is some portion of that line. That what is the other line that's?
Yeah, that's right. So it doesn't rule out flat. It just rules out flat with lambda equals zero.
Ah, okay.
Or, you know, alternatively, if it's flat, then it makes a measurement of what the lambda is. And this is, oh, by the way, this is the, you know, if you've heard like people say, oh, the universe is like 75% dark energy and 25% matter, this is, that's reading off this value, basically. Okay. Yeah.
What is the theoretical reason for that universe? What is usually said?
We're quickly going to go beyond what I can really talk about. Okay, that is whether triangles have, I think that's whether triangles have angles that form 180 degrees or not. Like basically whether the universe, the like curvature of the universe is zero, like flat or positive or negative. Okay, so that's all. That was the end of my example. So if there are questions here, then I'll be happy to take them. Oh, and I should say, these ellipses would have been probably produced, like would have certainly been produced by running Markov chain Monte Carlo. Like, it's kind of the, it's probably more or less the only tool you have to do that. Okay, so why we often need Markov chain Monte Carlo is that in real life, these models and likelihoods are often pretty complicated. So the constraints are kind of complicated, and we can't really represent them with in analytic form. But you can represent them by drawing samples from the distribution. And MCMC is a way of drawing samples from a probability distribution when you can compute it numerically, but you can't represent it analytically or can't solve it analytically. Okay, right, and I had just a couple, just little like sketches of results from the literature where they've used samplings to represent a kind of complicated or weird parameter space. And in the lab, you'll produce these little like corner plots like this. So a nice aspect of being able to draw samples from a distribution like this is that you can, if you only care about one of them, like say one of them is a nuisance parameter, you can project them off onto one of the axes and then read off that value, read off that distribution, and it's a like correct representation of your uncertainty in that parameter alone as well. They often come up in cosmology. It's all like contour plots of like what things, what parameters are allowed by certain data sets. Usually, as the field has like gone from very broad measurements to getting more precise, they've become more kind of elliptical and Gaussian. So it's kind of gotten boring. There used to be like large bananas in the chat. You were always like going for smaller and smaller bananas, but now it's kind of turned into oranges or something. It's not quite as exciting. But you know, this is a pretty weird looking probability space. Talking about whether, whether the initial conditions of the universe are Gaussian or not, basically, something like that. Okay, so back to Dan's flashy slides. Basically, you know, as I said before, MCMC lets you draw samples from a probability distribution, and all you have to do is to, all you have to be able to do is evaluate the function. So the generative modeling part is like all about laying out what that function is, and then MCMC allows you to draw samples from it, which then lets you make inferences and draw results from it. Okay, so right, so this is going to, the next handful of slides take you through just an illustration of how the algorithm works or what it looks like in action. And what we're looking at is, there are no axes, so the axes aren't labeled. That's not Dan's style. But we're imagining that we're in some parameter space, say that parameter space of like omega m, omega lambda, right? And we've taken some data set that constrains those parameters. And the contours are the probability contours. So the center of that contour would be an area in that parameter space that is consistent with the data. And then as you move away down on those contours, those parameters become more and more inconsistent with the data. Does that make sense? I know it's like kind of a very like abstract kind of illustration. Okay, so say, and I should say this, they're kind of different flavors of Markov chain Monte Carlo, MCMC, and one of them, by far the most common, is Metropolis Hastings. So it's just the kind of the details of the algorithm. But so in this algorithm, you choose some starting point in this parameter space, and then basically propose, you're going to basically move around a point or a sample or a walker, those are all sort of equivalent terms, by proposing to jump from one from where you are in the parameter space to some different place in the parameter space. Usually that proposal is some sort of like something like a Gaussian, like you say, oh, I'm just going to draw a Gaussian sample that moves me from where I am to some other place in the parameter space. And then you, this is too much math, but I can't really, I don't have the source file, so I can't modify Dan's slides. Once you've proposed moving to a new place, you compute whether the probability there is better or worse than where you were. And if it's better, you always take it. And if it's worse, you sometimes take it. And that sometimes is in proportion to how much worse it is. So if it's 25% as good, you take the jump 25% of the time. As Dan highlights, it only involves these relative probabilities. Most of the time, these Qs, which are that proposal distribution, usually they're symmetric, so the jumping one way or the other are the same, so they cancel out. And actually in the lab, I didn't even include that term because I was assuming Gaussian proposal distributions. Okay, and then you just iterate this process over and over. So propose jumping to a new place, accept the jump if it improves your probability, reject it if it doesn't, if it makes the probability worse, then probabilistically accept or reject it. And then that, you know, carries on and on. One little seems like a weird technicality or like a weird thing to do is that when you reject a move, you still store another copy of where you decided to stay in the result. In theory, it makes its way from wherever you initialized it to the bulk of the probability distribution, and then spends all its time happily wandering around that space, drawing samples from that distribution. At the end of the day, what you have is this bunch of samples, and what MCMC promises is that in the limit of infinite time, those samples are drawn fairly from that probability distribution. In the limit of infinite time is a pretty big catch. And it's why a lot of people actually actively work on MCMC instead of it just being a solved thing. Okay, so any questions about kind of the intuition part of the algorithm?
Maybe.
Any questions from Zoom? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Why is it important to store that second copy? If in, like, here it seems that you have a very large number of points anyway. Why would that make any relevant difference?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good question. I guess a kind of intuitive way of thinking about it is that it was a good enough place that you decided to stay there, even though you were given another choice of somewhere else to go. So it's then kind of fair to keep another copy of it. The way it comes out of the math is that in order for MC to actually do that thing it promises, to draw fairly from the distribution, you need to satisfy this condition called detailed balance. There's connections to thermodynamics or like thermal physics there. And basically it's like the once it's hit this like, I'm losing my words. Once it's hit the stable distribution, you need the probability of being at one point and jumping to another point for that to be reversible. And then basically storing that extra copy ensures that that holds. That's not a very satisfying answer in some ways, but yeah, kind of just comes out in the math. Anna?
I have one more question on, maybe you'll touch on it anyway, how this then links to really data analysis in cosmology, because I'm more from a condensed matter background where we, you know, use MC to compute without any data input, really, some expectation values, for example.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, it's more really distinct from any observational data. But do you combine this with actual data from observations?
Yeah. Okay, good. Yeah, that's a really good question. So in the data analysis context, basically the connection is that the this likelihood surface that I'm, or this probability surface that I'm, or like a terrain that I'm trying to reason about or draw samples from, that is built from the likelihood of an observational data set. Right, does that make sense? So like what that's telling you is basically how consistent a set of each place in that parameter space, how consistent that is with the data we observed. And now I think what you said was that you're also using like Monte Carlo methods for doing integrations or expectation values. Yeah, so that's another like huge use of Monte Carlo methods, where if you want to take an expectation value, you can think of is multiplying the height of the probability distribution times some function of the place in the parameter space. If you only cared about this x coordinate, if you wanted to say what the say mean x value x coordinate was, you could do that by integrating over this probability space times x. And that integral is often really hard to do, especially if you're in high dimensions. So then if you can draw samples from that probability distribution, then you can turn that integration into a sum over the function applied to each of the samples and then averaged out. Mm-hmm. Does that make any connection?
Yeah, maybe to follow up.
Sure.
In the plot you showed before of the constraints on the parameters, maybe I misunderstood. I thought the contour lines that they were from theory and that the line was from experiment. But so you're saying it's exactly the other way around. You use the data to construct some probability distribution Q that you then feed into the Monte Carlo to generate the contours, and then you look where the theory intersects the contours.
Yeah, okay, good, good, good. So I'm gonna rewind to the plot, the result plot from the example, and say what you just said again. So I'm sorry, I didn't really say that correctly. Yeah, so like you just said, what they would have done in this data analysis is run like an MCMC that would generate a ton of samples in this space, in this parameter space, where those samples are samples that are consistent with their data. And those samples would have been within those contours. And then they would have done something like, take the, plotted out the contours to turn those samples into something they can like plot in their paper. The contours here are totally driven by representing the posterior probability distribution for their model parameters given their data. It's kind of like how their data constrain the model.
Okay, that's perfect. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. That was a great question.
We also have a question from the online participant.
Yeah, go for it. Do you want to unmute and read it out?
Yeah. So I'll ask it for Eve. How are we sure this algorithm would lead to the parameter space in a finite time, and not just turning around from point to point far from the parameter space?
Good. Okay. How do you know it will converge in finite time? partly that is actually, that is a big question. One way that can fail, or one way this algorithm can fail or in practice, is that if you started out in some poor part of the parameter space, it will tend to find some local maximum. And then if there's like a, if you think about it as a terrain, it will go to the top of the nearest mountain probably. And then if there's a big prairie and then a much higher mountain, it's very unlikely to take all the steps it would require to find that other taller mountain and then spend all its time there where it really ought to be. So in the limit of infinite time, it will get there. And then it'll hike back down and come over to the shorter mountain and spend some time there, and then hike over there again infinitely often. But that's not much of a consolation if you have a finite lifetime. So that's definitely, like, in practice, that's a total concern. At a coarser level, like, why do you think, like, why isn't it just a random walk? Is because it's paying attention to how the relative probabilities when it's deciding to take each step. So it's not, it's not unconditionally taking each step and doing a random walk. It's doing this kind of directed random walk. I hope that helps.
I think that answers the question. To rephrase the first part of what you said, you can fall in some closer metastable state, which is like a local equilibrium, local maximum of this probability, and fail to actually access the true minimum.
Yeah, that's right.
Too far.
Right. Exactly. In practice, you can fall into you can spend all of your time in a local maximum. Which people usually get around by, or like one way in practice of trying to avoid that is to start from different places in the parameter space. And if you consistently find a place, that kind of increases your confidence that that's the right answer. But it's if your state space is complicated enough, there could always be like a, a pinnacle that's like right there and you would never find it. Usually you know enough about your probability space that that's not the case, but it can, in high dimensions where things aren't as intuitive, it can happen.
One more question.
Sure.
Was about your Q X prime X.
Uh-huh.
Can you say a bit more?
Sure. and the other catch is that the way it's written down is actually wrong. The cues should be flipped. It's just an error in the slides. But again, I asked Dan for updated slides, and I think he's also lost the original sources. But basically, that's for scenarios where the probability of jumping in one direction is not equal to the probability of jumping in the other direction. Then you just have to fold in that that extra factor. But if you're doing something like a Gaussian, then it's symmetric, so the probability of jumping either direction is the same, so then they just cancel out. And what the cues actually are is this probability of jumping from, of arriving at x if you started at x prime, or in order for the math to work out the opposite of that. If you want this expression to be correct, then q is the probability of jumping at 2x prime given that you started at x. You can see that if your distribution is symmetric, then those are the same, so they then just cancel out. Good? Okay. All right. Oh, 2:50, and we're going till 3. So yeah, okay, perfect, good. I still haven't told you like what this whole Markov chain Monte Carlo is about. It sounds so like big and impressive, but the Monte Carlo is just a reference to a casino in Monaco. Fancy casino, very nice apparently. I've never been there. It's a little bit above my social level. And it just alludes to the fact that there's randomness used in the algorithm, which, you know, when it was developed in the 50s, that was quite a thing, that we could draw random numbers and use that in our data analysis. It's a pretty wild idea. Markov chain is, like I said, this isn't it's not a random walk. It's a directed walk, directed walk. And in that, so, you know, it's funny, like a chain is just a list here. It's just a list of your samples. And the Markov property is that each one is generated by a process that only depends on where you were before. You know, like you only pay attention to your current state to generate the next state. So in other words, it doesn't know the whole history, it just knows the current state and makes a decision of where to jump next based on that. So that's the like Markov property. And I just, in preparing these slides, I was reading up about Andrei Markov, who has this like glorious mustache and beard, as you'd expect from like a 19th century Russian mathematician. And there's a Wikipedia page, like huge page, that has things that are named after him. So I can't really give justice to his extensive accomplishments. I said this particular flavor I presented here is Metropolis Hastings, who are the lead authors of the papers that kind of developed this specific algorithm and implemented it on computers of the day. I should say, at least for the Metropolis one, there's some like argument about who should get the credit. But it tends to be, the name has stuck pretty hard, so. I left it till 8 minutes till the end to actually show you the algorithm, but that's fine because it's only like 12 lines long. This is a kind of Python style version of it. So you would get passed in a function that allows you to evaluate the probability at a given place in the state, in the parameter space or state space. You get passed in a proposal function that, if you're in one place, proposes to jump to a new place. You're given a starting point and how many steps you'd like to run for. Okay. So we're going to keep this P, that's your, like your current place in that state space, start out at where you at the initial position, and start out by computing the probability at that place. So call that probability function with your current position. And then start recording this chain, or you know, just list of sample places. So for each step in the algorithm, we propose a new position in parameter space. We're going to do that by calling that propose func that's going to propose a new jump.
And this is the step that requires, that depends only on the...
Yeah, that's right. It's going to depend on P. So it's going to, I'm going to fill in what those actually are. I just didn't want to like blast you with the whole thing at once. And then we're going to compute the probability at that new place and then decide whether we want to jump there or not. And then regardless of whether we jump or not, we'll save the point where we ultimately decide to either jump or stay. And then at the end, just return that list of values, that chain. Okay, so it probably won't super surprise you that how these values get filled in. So to propose a value, you call the propose func with the place where you are, and it gives you a new value. Computing the probability of that new place is, you know, a matter of calling the probability function for that new value. And then the decision part is, I'll spend a minute on this because it's a little bit, this is kind of one way of writing it that's not totally obvious, but so it draws a uniform random number between 0 and 1. Which means that if the probability at the new place is larger than the probability where you were, like if you propose to jump to a better place, then that value is greater than 1. So it's always greater than whatever uniform random number you would draw. So you could like rewrite that in a way where you would check if it's bigger first and then not draw the random number if you didn't have to. But you know, this is like a kind of compact way of writing it down. Whereas if, say, the probability at the new place is a quarter as big, then this is a quarter, and that will be larger than a uniform random number drawn between 0 and 1 a quarter of the time. You know, 3/4 of the time the uniform random number will be larger than that, and then you will reject the move. So, you know, basically then if that, if this holds, then you decide to jump to the new place, you update your position with the new position, and your probability with the new probability. And otherwise, you just stay where you were, so P stays the same, and prob stays the same. Make sense? Okay. I'm gonna add like two practicalities. in practice, we almost always work in log probabilities, partly because these probabilities can get small, and then you multiply them together, so you can get like small, like very small numbers. And so if you have like a large number of data points, then that number can become so small that it underflows what you can easily store in a computer, and your probability turns to zero, and then you're unhappy. So yeah, usually we work in log probabilities, which just means that, you know, basically you end up the decision has to convert back from log space back into actual probability space. So you know, instead of the division to compare them, you're doing a minus, and then you have to exponentiate the result. But other than that, it's basically, you know, just all the same. One additional practicality is that usually we track how often the jumps are accepted. So you know, want to keep track of like how many times you accepted a proposed jump. Because if basically because you will want to be able to tune that proposal distribution. Because if it's proposing that you take these huge jumps all the time, then if you're anywhere near the good part of the parameter space, all those jumps are going to be terrible, because like you're in a decent place and It's proposing to jump very far away, so many of those will be rejected. And then if you propose to take tiny steps, they'll often be accepted, but it just takes you forever to get anywhere. So anyway, that's just part of the like practicalities of tuning the algorithm, and the lab goes into quite a lot of detail about that. I'm basically at time, so I'm gonna wrap up. Gonna do the horrible thing. So kind of two main practicalities of running this algorithm are like, how do I choose a proposal distribution, and how many steps do I have to take to get a good result? When I showed you the intuitive demo part, it nicely just scattered points all along that parameter space. In practice, if you have, this is a fairly big proposal distribution, so if you're in that sort of situation, like a lot of the proposals are going to be that, like, you're kind of on this ridge of probability, and it's proposing that you jump off the ridge. You're like, no, I'm not going to do that. So you can then spend a lot of time deciding to stay where you are, which means that you're not really sampling the state space very much. So that's one way of getting a small acceptance fraction. And then conversely, if you propose taking tiny steps, it just takes you forever to get from one place to another. And that results in a large acceptance fraction. And kind of both of those things mean that you're not spending your time very effectively. So there's a kind of tuning that you have to do. And in Metropolis Hastings, you basically have to do that tuning by hand. I'm going to steal a couple of minutes from the lecture, because what's happening is lecture, coffee break, and then lab. So I'm stealing the time from myself. Ideally, you would choose your proposal distribution to kind of match the shape of the probability distribution, which then would mean that if you're on the ridge, instead of proposing to jump off the ridge, you could propose large steps along the ridge, or small steps orthogonal to the ridge. Now the problem with that is that in two dimensions, that's three parameters you have to set, right? The variances and the covariance. But as you go into larger parameter spaces, it just explodes. The number of kind of parameters you have to tune by hand is quadratic. So as Dan says, you would like for the number of parameters gives you scientific awesomeness. And it would be good if your inference method was flat and the difficulty didn't increase as your awesomeness increased, but Metropolis Hastings is quadratic in how hard it is based on how much awesomeness you want to try to achieve, which is not ideal. Go ahead.
The
problem. exactly. That's a problem. You've exactly nailed the problem. It's an issue. So you could, because that's one of the things you learn from running it is what that space looks like and what the you could think about running it for a bit and then figuring out what that looks like and then using that as your proposal distribution, which means you have to run the algorithm before running the algorithm. You can try to adapt it as you go, but it's very difficult to get that right without breaking detailed balance. And then you end up not sampling the correct probability distribution. So yeah, in practice, that's hard. Yeah.
But why do we need to know what the contour lines look like? And why is it not enough to just know the functional form of the distribution?
Yeah, to do that, if you want to try to sculpt the proposal distribution to match it, which allows you to take good steps, basically, or like to take mm-hmm. effective steps. Okay. Sorry, I hope that. So I'm going to try to like draw a connection to symmetry, the topic of the workshop. It's maybe a little tenuous, but I think it kind of works. Metropolis Hastings, you need to tune this proposal distribution. And in some sense, that's kind of like because it lacks this symmetry, right? Like if you, it's sensitive to the parameterization of the problem. If you rescaled it with an affine transformation, like you said, instead of inferring omega m and omega lambda, inferred some sum of them or some difference between them, then you would go from like, you might go from like a hard space to sample from to one that was like orthogonal or like isotropic, that's the word I'm looking for. It's like with just an affine transformation, you can turn a hard problem into an easy problem. That's kind of weird. Like it seems like it shouldn't be hard in the first place if you can get between easy and hard with just an affine transformation. That's sort of saying this lacks the symmetry to the affine an invariance to the affine transformation. So I have a lecture next week at the same time where I'm going to show you an alternative algorithm that actually does have that affine invariance. So then it avoids having to set all of these tuning parameters, which then means that you're on the orange line of like happiness as scientific awesomeness increases. Kind of, it still has its own challenges, of course, because there's nothing's ever free. But yeah, that's my attempt to draw a connection to symmetries. Okay. All right, I'm a little, okay. Okay, this is gonna be quick. So another big question is how many samples do I need? When do I know I'm done? And that's also a hard question to actually answer in practice. So an easy part of it is to answer is that since you initialize it in some like random place in the parameter space, the first bit where it's walking to try to find the bulk of the probability space, that's kind of garbage and you just throw those away. Exactly how long that takes is not something that you can easily often tell a priori. So it often involves a lot of just like looking at plots and deciding, oh yeah, there it, you know, it took it a thousand steps to make it to the core of the probability distribution. The other big one, like another big kind of set of questions is, comes out as, has my chain converged? Which also means like, am I walking around the small hill and there's a large mountain that I should be looking at? And I'll get there eventually. And people usually try to answer that by maybe running it a few different times and ensuring that the results are consistent. And then another big set of challenges is that this, because it's a chain of steps, those steps are all correlated with each other, or like are correlated. Whereas like really you want uncorrelated samples from your distribution. So then, and basically what you, and in practice what you kind of have to do is say, I'm gonna just ignore like, I'm gonna just keep like every 10th sample or every 100th sample because they're correlated enough that although there's 100 samples, it's really only drawing like one independent sample. 100's probably a little pessimistic, but you know, maybe 10 or 20 samples. Those samples aren't really independent samples. They're kind of all tied together. And you know, there are ways of measuring what that number is and how many you have to keep and so on. And then the other one is like, okay, how many, I've reduced it down to uncorrelated samples. Now, how many samples do I need? That's also not like super easy to give an answer for. And you know, often the answer is like, how much time do you have until you have to give up and admit there is, and you know, publish your paper or whatever. Or basically like, does the result plot look good enough yet? You know, because if you're like, if you're mapping out a parameter space and drawing contours, then if you haven't drawn enough samples, then your contour looks all jaggy when it actually isn't. And then as you draw more samples, it'll get to be smooth contours. That's not a very satisfying answer, but there it is. Yeah, I know. Sorry, this is a Dan joke, but basically, this is kind of related to Anna's question earlier about another reason to draw samples is if you're trying to do an integration, like try to find an expectation value over a function times a probability. If you can draw samples, then you can turn that integration into a sum. And then the catch, or like one answer to how many samples do I need, is that the error on that goes as the number of independent samples, 1/√ of the number of independent samples. So that's kind of one like numerical way of answering, like kind of how many samples do I need. I think you went to a different middle school than I did. Okay, so finally, at the end, when I practiced last night, I was short on time, so I was expansive in spending my time. Okay, so, you know, although it was kind of written down in the 50s, MCMC remains this kind of a central tool that's everywhere. And basically, you know, it's because it lets us do this really important job of drawing samples from a distribution. And for in physics, or at least one thing you can do with that in physics is to do Bayesian inference. And you know, it has this like simple algorithm and this like beautiful theoretical property that only holds as compute time goes to infinity. So it has this like a frustrating combination of like beauty and simplicity and like hassle in practice. As a result, you know, people still talk about it and give lectures on it and struggle with it and have unkind things to say about computers thanks to it. You'll hopefully get to see some of that this afternoon and have your own unhappiness with computers. Thanks. Yeah, so the lab session. We'll use Google, as I said before, we'll use Google Colab, so that's a web-based thing. You don't have to install anything on your own computer, it runs in a browser, and it's in Python, and what I've done is make a notebook that has most of the structure of the code, and then there's some places where you have to write in code, and then like a bunch of instructions for things to try, and so you can like go back and play around with parameters and try making different plots and stuff like that to try to give you just some experience of trying to mess with things yourselves and have fun with it.
Dustin,
yeah.
One last question from from the online participant. Can you go back to the code page, the one where you had?
Sorry, which one?
The one with the code.
The code, sure. Boom, 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 boom. There.
So the question was why you picked a uniform distribution and whether the result can change. Yeah, if you pick something else.
Sure. You have to use uniform to keep detailed balance. So that's one part where you don't really have any choice. It's basically because you have to make that, you have to accept or reject it based on that ratio of probabilities. So if you use something different, then you just don't sample the correct probability space. You just don't draw samples in the correct proportion to the probability there. And those can be subtle. Like if you don't always save, like if you put this inside the if statement, like you only save a point when you accept it, the results can be subtle, but you just, you know, as you run it for longer and longer, you just don't converge to the right answer, which is kind of a hazard. All right,
okay.
Any final questions?
Good. So
no, thank you very much.